Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
War is afoot.
I am to inherit the Iron Throne. She will block my way.
Hello and welcome back to Still Watching, the television podcast from Vanity Fair. We cover entire seasons of the hottest shows on TV, and right now we are diving deep into House of the Dragon, the Game of Thrones prequel series on HBO. I'm Josh Wigler, and here to discuss House of the Dragon Episode 9, here to stage a podcast coup with me, it is Richard Lawson. Richard.
A soft coup, don't worry.
A soft coup.
I'm not going to be hanging anybody or...
No.
You know, I might bust a dragon through the floor of something, but that's it.
Totally.
And that wasn't
possible.
Really even part of the coup, so.
Not really. That's like sort of like the appropriate response to the coup, I think, to some degree.
Yeah. That was actually Eve Best quitting the show. That's how she left set. She was like, I've had enough. And
I wish that I could say that that is like the last that we will see of Rhaenys Targaryen. Not because I want her to leave the show. I love the character. She has more to do for sure. But gosh, what an exit that would be.
That was a way to make a big move at Tribal. To keep belaboring our survivor thing. That was the ultimate, I have two immunity idols.
Yeah. It was like the idol nullifier, I feel like. It's like one of those really unexpected twists that like no one prepared the, like they had everything about Aegon's coronation prepared, but these fools, they had it at the dragon pit. You gotta make sure that the dragons are being watched.
Yeah.
It's very important that you have monitored situation on the dragons if you're hosting your very controversial coronation in the literal dragon pit.
And maybe make sure you absolutely know where each of the dragon riders is.
That's also important. Very important. So we are talking about episode 9. It is the Green Council. And of course, we know that green is that Hightower color. No surprise here. And yet still shocking, Richard, that after 8 episodes of buildup, of wondering, like, is this going to boil over into some sort of civil war type of situation? The death of King Viserys absolutely paves the way for the lid to be blown off of this slow simmering conflict. Mm-hmm. 20 years in the making. We are officially in it now, folks.
Potentially even more than 20 years, because I think we'll have to see what next episode holds, because Rhaenyra is not in this episode. And so from what we know from this episode, it kind of seems like Rhaenys starts the Civil War. I mean, obviously, going over the succession, that is obviously the key to it. But it seems that Rhaenys is the first person to respond in force, really.
Yes. So she is kind of the first representative of potentially Rhaenyra's side of the storyline, who is who's going to have eyes on this highway robbery, this Hightowerway robbery of the Iron Throne. And her response is obviously seismic, but perhaps appropriate given many of the ways in which this all rolls out. It was a really tense episode of the show for me, even having read Fire and Blood, the book on which this is based, and having you know, some good ideas of how this is going to go down. There's some swerves here for sure, some ways in which the show zigged where the book zagged, some embellishments here and there, different like stagings of some important scenes, like the small council scene isn't in the small council in the book. There's a lot more of a lid kept on Viserys's death in the book than there is on the show. I think like Viserys is left to rot in his chamber for something like a week in the book before they really get into it, before they start announcing what has happened to him. The show takes a little bit of a different path and adds a couple of things. There's one thing in particular in this episode. I was like, I don't think we needed that at all. Looking at Larys Strong right now. But a lot that is happening in
what
this.
What part of Larys Strong are you looking at, though?
I'm not looking at anything. I'm doing everything
I'm wearing
that
my
I can.
Shoes.
Look, yeah.
But I'm wearing socks and shoes right now, by the way, just in case.
Well, I'm wearing sandals, but I am also wearing socks. So,
So practical and fashionable. That's
So it's finally starting to pay off here as the socks and sandals combo is showing up. What did you think of this one, Richard?
I thought it was exciting. You know, I think there were genuinely things in this episode I didn't expect to see, you know, or expect to happen. I love an episode that lets an actor like Eve Best just go for it. And she's so good as Rhaenys. And I think this show overall has been pretty good about centering women in the story. I mean, and you also see that evidenced by the fact that Claire Kilner directed this. The episode was written by Sarah Hess. So you have women behind the camera in two major positions. And then you close the episode with a character who was, you know, important, but maybe she was an interesting supporting figure, all of a sudden assert herself and in grand fashion. And that was really exciting. And I genuinely don't know what happens next, which feels great.
Yeah, there's no Rhaenyra in this episode. This is the first House of the Dragon episode without both Viserys Targaryen and Rhaenyra Targaryen, one of whom will return to the show for sure. But these are two really important players in the narrative thus far who are absent from the episode. And so in addition to it being the Rhaenys Targaryen breakout episode, Richard, this is really Hightower City, right? You know, like we really get to see what King's Landing looks like when it's covered in green. What did you think about that? For me, it felt like kind of a different vibe, but in a really exciting way.
Well, yeah, Rhaenyra is off drinking Negroni Spagliato with Prosecco.
With Prosecco.
If anyone's seen the amazing video of Emma Darcy saying what their favorite drink is. If you haven't seen it, go watch it.
I don't drink anymore, Richard, but even now, if I were to get a drink, Negroni would be pretty far down on the list for me.
Yeah, oh, same. Yeah. But Emma Darcy makes it sound good. Yes, I agree that it did feel different having the Hightower ascendancy, you know, but what I think was an interesting aspect of that was that aside from the fact that a platinum blonde Targaryen incest prince is going to be put in the top position, everything else, you know, with the Hightower ascendancy and the King's Council, that felt more like what we meet when we start Game of Thrones with the Baratheons in power.
Right.
You know, that was, we don't have these messianic psychos from across the sea ruling us. We have like regular Westerosi people who are not quite, you know, they're not guided by prophet and vision and all that, and dragons and all that stuff. Yes, it was kind of a half, like that there were absolute Targaryens being installed into power here. But yeah, I thought it was a interesting to see, like, would the world of King's Landing or Westeros as a whole, like, is it, it probably is better to have a more practical governorship versus this kind of magic crazy one, even if they're using the magic crazy to get into power.
Yeah, I thought this episode was really interesting in conversation with the same episode of Game of Thrones, the first episode 9 of GOT, where it's not a coronation scene that you're getting at the end of Baelor, but you are getting this really big, grand, kingly moment in Joffrey's decision to, you know, off with his head to Ned Stark. And here in House of the Dragon, it is a coronation, but there are these two big public kingly events. And two different tacts are taken. With Joffrey, no mercy is shown, the Cobra Kai way towards Ned Stark. And here at the end of this episode, with the Queen Who Never Was, who earlier in the episode is told by Alicent, you should have been the Queen, it should have been you, she shows what it looks like when mercy is rendered. And she chooses not to eviscerate these people with dragon fire. And I'm just thinking about the endings of those two different episodes and how they are both like they're parallel tracks, but they're very different choices that are made there. Mm-hmm. And neither path, Richard, leads to peace, I can tell you. You know, like I just thought that that was really interesting. I kept waiting for there to be some sort of huge jaw-dropping twist in episode 9 in the Green Council, as per a Game of Thrones tradition. And I think if there was a twist, the twist is like, you know what? I'm not going to just bathe you in dragon fire. You're going to live right with this choice and you're going to live to regret it.
Yeah. And I think that Rhaenys's choice, you know, it felt sort of righteous and not quite good exactly, but, you know, at least not outright murderous, except that she did kill a lot of regular folks who live in town. I mean, you have to imagine that dragon bursting through, swinging its tail everywhere. A lot of those townsfolk who were gathered to witness the coronation did not survive. And I think that this episode...
But we don't care about them, right? Well, small folk, but Richard.
I think the episode did do a good job, you know, in a way that even it didn't, that Game of Thrones didn't do, of being like, right, there is a whole teeming city of people here. And yes, they're in rags and they live horribly, especially in Flea Bottom. It had me kind of wondering, like, what's the Park Slope of King's Landing? Like, does it exist? Like, you know,
Stroller City. Yeah.
Yeah. But like, the streets it does kind of matter that the people applauded. You know, the calculus was like, oh, I don't think that the people are going to want a female ruler, but we have to go with it because it's what Viserys wanted. And then things change. And you see this tentativeness with which Aegon, who's a drunk and a womanizer and doesn't really want to be, and a rapist, really want to be doing this at all. And everyone's kind of nervously waiting to see what the crowd is going to do, how they're going to react. And they seem to like it. And Aegon seems to like it. And that seems to shore up some support, which, like, I don't think we've seen an outright, like, rebellion from the hoi polloi on these shows yet. But, like, that is something that people, I'm sure, in power would have to think about. And so, whereas I think it's fun in a narrative TV watching sense that Rhaenys did what she did, was it smart? Because now the people of King's Landing are probably not pro that side based on what happened. And so is it better to establish this fear? And if you were going to do it, why not go all the way and just kill everyone else? You
know? No half measures, Walter. Yeah. Right. You know, I think it's a very interesting point. I think it's also really worth putting that pin in what is the perspective of the people on the streets of King's Landing, and how are they feeling about the ascendancy of Aegon Targaryen? How are they going to respond to Rhaenys's big move here, and how is that going to splash back on Rhaenyra, who may not have been a popular choice to begin with? I think all of these are really important questions to keep in mind as this show is clearly evolving into its next stage. And whether or not we really get rooted in the perspective of the people of King's Landing, I certainly hope so at a certain point in time. We're not totally there yet, but I do agree that this episode, I think, did the best job of that since maybe, was it episode 4, when Rhaenyra and Daemon are going out for their memorable night out on the town. A lot is changing here in House of the Dragon. A lot is happening here on the podcast, as we're just going to have one more beyond this point. We have the season finale coming your way next week. We would love to get your feedback in anticipation of that. You can send it in stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. That's stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. We've got a good amount of feedback for this episode as well, which we'll get into deeper into the episode. But first, let's recap it. We'll do it scene by scene right after this quick commercial break. Stay tuned.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically, I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, Richard, we are back. We are talking about The Green Council. It is directed by Claire Kilner. It is written by Sarah Hess. And it begins with a series of scenes that felt almost like a promo reel for me. Like I could see the alternate world where this is like the season two teaser, Richard. We're going through King's Landing. We're going through the Red Keep. It's quiet. There's no activity. The throne room is empty. All of these rooms are empty. And just Ramin Djawadi's haunting piano keys are being tickled underneath it all. It's a dark night. It's torch lit. And then we are swallowed into the drama of Viserys Targaryen is dead and how that is going to be rippling out to everything else. A very haunting opening, I thought.
Especially because you then start to think, oh no, it's so bad that these people know this. You know,
yes.
It's so bad that this kid knows it, that this maid knows it. I mean, we kind of later find out that, you know, there are spies within the castle. So not everyone is innocent, but like, this is dangerous information.
Yeah. Team spies, by the way. Let me just say.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, generally speaking, like just cool job, really cool job. But
And it's working. You know, this all-powerful ruling class, but like, well, there are some cracks in that if people who are hiding in the shadows can have a big effect on things.
Yeah, Lara Strong is going to talk about the web of spiders and the network they have weaved in here. And like, I kind of want to see, like, what's the SD6 of King's Landing?
Right.
Like, I kind of want to know. Like, I want some more, like, intentional in-universe wig work. Is that too much to ask for, Richard? I don't know.
Are we going to meet House Rimbaldi next season?
Yeah. Yes. This whole thing is an Alias prequel. I'm pretty happy about that. So Allison is going to hear the news that Viserys has died. She and Otto are going to be alone together. And she is going to reveal to Otto that she was with him, moments before he passed away. And that his last wish, among his final words, were for Aegon to be the king. She says, it's the truth. It was his last wish. It was his last words to me. And I was the only one to hear it. And now he is dead. So, Richard, this episode is really going to lean in on the idea of Alicent really fully believing, it seems like, this miscommunicated bit of information that Viserys wants Aegon to sit on the throne and not Rhaenyra. And I wondered how much you feel like, is this her really authentically believing in that? Is this something that is a little more desperate and confused than that? To pull in some of the feedback a little bit early, we had gotten this from Brianna, who had written in and said, I wanted to bring in a wrinkle from the last episode, Lord of the Tides, regarding the last scene with Alicent and Viserys. You mentioned that Alicent may have confused Viserys' ramblings on Aegon to mean her son should be on the throne and that there's no malice but innocent confusion. But when she asks him, our son, he pointedly says no. So even if Alicent assumes Viserys is rambling mad with the rest of his message or is confused about it in general since she doesn't know about the dream, she knows that she doesn't have the only Aegon in the realm. And who's to say Viserys isn't talking about Rhaenyra's Aegon? So my question to you after that, Richard, is, do you feel like this episode bears out that Alicent really authentically misinterpreted what Viserys had to say about Aegon in his final moments? Or is this a convenience for her? Or is she even lost in some measure of like the panic of the situation?
Well, I think you could look at it a couple ways. Like maybe Alicent heard what she wanted to hear. But also, I think maybe it was an innocent mistake, A, because she doesn't know about this mythology that he was right. that I think he was referring to. And B, like, why wouldn't he be talking about his own son on what looked to be his deathbed? Why would he be referencing the first ever, you know, guy from however long ago? So I think this was a genuinely innocent misunderstanding that obviously is getting out of hand and leading to terrible things. But I don't know. I think Alicent is more about just protecting the family and herself than she is about holding ultimate power. That's kind of her father's thing. I think maybe there's 40% of Alicent that wants that power, too. I'm not saying she's totally checked right. out of the game.
Well, that's but what Rhaenys is going to say. Like, you never thought about yourself on the Iron Throne? Alicent can't right. really respond to that. She's like, I've thought about it.
Well, of course. I mean, how could you not? You know,
right.
because maybe that is just viewed as simple safety. You know, like if I'm on top, then there, you know, I'm that much less at risk or I'm more at risk. I don't know. So I think Alicent continues to be a fascinating character because it's not really clear. And in a smart way, not in a lazy writing way, it's not really clear what she wants exactly. And I think that's because she's figuring it out as she goes.
I think that that's probably the key for me is I'm more clear on what she believes right now. I think that she believes that Viserys intended for Aegon to sit on the throne. I am still less clear on what it is she really wants. You know, like, I think like those are two different things. And what does Allison actually want out of this situation? Probably would be to be like out of this situation, to like not be in this situation, I think, is the thing that she would want the most. Now that she is, I think you break it down quite eloquently of like, maybe I'm on top so that I'm less at risk, but perhaps being on top puts me more at risk. There aren't a lot of great directions for her to go in.
Well, right. And you have to think about, like, what is the conversation she had with teenage Aegon, like, the first time we met him was like, you have to take this seriously because, like, when she becomes queen, we are all in danger. So she knows that, too. So maybe, okay, by the, you know, somehow, by the grace of the seven, my husband, right before he died, changed his mind, thus protecting us for one more tribal, you know, like, we're okay for the next round of this game. But look, these people are in a precarious position no matter what. And I think that's the poignancy of what this show has done. I think the most poignant thing this show has done so far is show these characters who are stuck both by choice and by circumstance, by chance, in these positions, like that glimmer of a way out. A way to just walk away. It's not realistic for most of them, but like that it kind of hangs there in the distant periphery must be sort of, you know, painfully tantalizing that like maybe there's a life where I just kind of like enjoy myself for once.
Yeah. When she talks about like, you know, Viserys would have been happy to just be a country lord. I feel like part of that is like, and I would have been really happy to just stay in Old Town.
That's probably everyone in this group's fantasy, ultimately. I mean, maybe not the really power hungry people, but like a lot of the others are like, geez, so you're saying I could just be rich and ineffectual somewhere, like in a castle? That sounds nice.
Yeah. Otto really does feel like he's now living his best life.
He's thrilled.
We go to the small council meeting where we're going to be for a good chunk of time. And this was a really awaited scene of like, how is this going to be? This information is, how's it going to be meted out? And the people who are going to resist in this moment and how that's going to go. So this was a really exciting sequence for me, even as it was a bit different from how the book goes. But it does feel to me like Otto is like, from here on throughout this episode, he's like, his belt is like one notch looser, you know, like he's like really able to like stop holding in the ambition and just lay it all out on the table. He tells everybody, so we've got some bad news, the bad news and the good news. The bad news is Viserys is dead. The good news is he wants Aegon to succeed him. And so all of these secret schemes that we've been plotting unbeknownst to everybody else, including Allison, we can just turn the key and activate all of that. So it seems like these contingencies have been in place with at least a group of small council, Richard, that they were preparing for the day that Viserys died, that they would stage this coup one way or the other.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. This was, they had never accepted Rhaenyra, you know, and it was all just a waiting game and a plotting game and you know, kind of quietly getting people aligned with them. And the tragedy of that is that Allison, I think, genuinely didn't know that this was happening.
She seems to, yeah, it seems to be that's the case, that Allison seems to be really upset that this has happened, that Otto has made these moves, that he's ready to, like, he's identified the people on the City Watch who are loyal to Daemon. Let's get rid of those people. Let's, you know, get to Dragonstone and give them the chance, but we're not really going to give them the chance, and we'll probably just kill Rhaenyra and her entire family. Like, Allison would not have approved of any of this. She knows that Viserys would not have approved of any of this. And this is sideswiping her. This, you know, she's already sort of in some measure of mourning. There's a shell-shocked quality about Allison here. Even if she believes that her husband wanted authentically their son to be the ruler and she wants to honor that or whatever it is that she's, you know, wanting to do or choosing to do, she doesn't want it to be done in this like horrific shadow schemey way. So she's sort of the first objector, like vocal objector in the room, but she's far from the last vocal objector in the room, as poor Lord Lyman Beesbury is going to die for speaking his mind.
Yes. Yeah. At the hands of a increasingly erratic, rash Kristen, who I think is emerging as this fascinatingly broken character who is like, like he got rejected by one girl like 15 years ago.
And he's carried that now, a good long way.
Like
yeah.
crazy. And I think, you know, that's just further like Allison is like, what situation am I in? You know, yeah. and she's realizing that like these men that she, you know, she knew that her father manipulated her into getting into Viserys' good graces. But I think that she had let herself think, well, you know, like that was then, this is now. Like, I think I'm respected here. I think I have genuine power here. I think Kristen is like a genuine, trusty ally. And now she's like, no, all of these guys are crazy and all they don't really think about me at all. I'm just a pawn that now is increasingly less valuable.
Yeah, she's just a player on the board, but she feels like she has some pieces of her own. And I think that she thinks of Kristen, maybe she thinks of Kristen in that way. I don't quite know how she views him. When she's going to talk to him later and send him out to King's Landing, you know, she is going to trade on the like, however you feel about me, you have to know how important this is. You know, it feels like she is really leaning into that power dynamic of I helped you, I scratched your back, time to scratch mine. In any event, Kristen, yeah, he just is vibrating with all of this fury that has been collecting over these past few years. And it kind of feels like he's here in this moment where, like, he's going to have yet another opportunity to just off a person and maybe get away with it. So some form of, like, murder truth comes out in Kristen Cole as Lord Beesbury is the only person in the room up to this point who is saying that this is not right. Aegon is an imposter. People swore their oath to Rhaenyra. I'm an old man. I'm 76. I do not believe that this is what Viserys would have wanted, especially with his wife as his only witness. This is treason. And for the sheer crime of speaking the truth, Kristen bashes Lord Beesbury's head into the table, one-shots him. That's the end of Lyman Beesbury. The book has it that there's no question that Lord Beesbury died at this moment and in this capacity of speaking the truth and dying for it. But I think that there's a lot of questions about how it played out. There's some perspectives in the book that he gets locked up and just sent to the dungeons. There's another version where he has his throat slit in the room by Kristen Cole. Another really wild version where Kristen Cole just throws him out a window. So the show went a different route, but Lord Beesbury's days were numbered the moment he showed up on screen. And I was really curious to see how they were going to do this.
Yeah. And this is sort of the head smash heard around the world. You know, this is right. The first death in this war. And, the sort of small little, you know, pathetic tragedy of Beesbury is that like, no one's going to remember that, you know,
right.
This won't be but it is, this is a huge deal that this happens.
Yeah, blood has been spilled. And it's a big deal for Harold Westerling, the Graham McTavish character, who has kind of just been the strong silent type for so much of this show. He's going to speak his mind. He's going to kind of have a Barristan the Bold kind of moment here where he pulls his sword out against Kristen. Kristen pulls his out in kind. You think that this might turn into like a full on battle here in the small council chamber. And ultimately it de-escalates to a point. But Harold is going to quit on the spot. So he was the Lord Commander of the Kingsguard. He shall be Lord Commander no more. He's going to strip off his cloak and say, I recognize no authority but the king's. And until there is one, I have no place here. And he walks out of the room.
But he's sort of leaving the window open. I could come, the door open. I could come back if once you guys figure this out. I just don't want to be part of this part. You know, this interim thing. No, thank you.
With him out of the room, with Harold gone, There are questions about next steps, and this is where Otto is really saying, well, we're going to have to imprison Rhaenyra, and they're going to be given an opportunity to bend at the knee, and Allison says, you know they're not going to do it. Daemon is never bending the knee to you. You're just planning on killing them off. And I was like, well, you know, basically, yes. That's basically what I'm planning to do. So the stakes are established in this moment that this does not look good for the folks on Dragonstone who know nothing of this at this point in time.
We've all been in a position where our father tells us to our face, I want to kill your friend from grade school. You know, like it's just a thing that happens.
Yeah. And you don't forget that. That really stuck with me. It was a pretty horrific moment. Helena, we're going to get like the perspective of the kids as they're going to find out that their father is gone. Helena has a really dramatic reaction. She is there with her children, just, you know, hanging out with her kids when she gets the news that Viserys is gone. She has no idea where Aegon is either. She says something about a beast beneath the boards, Richard. Is she foretelling the arrival of Rhaenys on Dragonback at the end of this episode?
Well, hadn't you mentioned a few weeks ago that she might have that thing? What was it? I forget the term.
It seems like she's a Targaryen dreamer. Of the Targaryens who does have that ability to see some glimpse of the future.
Right, which, you know, then I start to wonder just from a, you know, TV writing perspective, like, okay, so is she just going to pop up on occasion and say something kind of creepy mystical, or is that like, is Helaena going to sort of enter this in a bigger way at some point? I don't know. I kind of like her as this just sort of, she kind of floats in for a second, says something interesting, and then floats away. But I don't know, maybe they have bigger plans for her.
Helaena's read the book. She has the spoilers. Tread lightly around Helaena. Aemond comes in, he's catching wind of the news, and just the way that Aemond looks, this really seems like a man who's like, okay, time to do the thing I was born for. I'm ready to go to war. Let's do this.
Born for, and yet also not quite born for, because, you know, he's like, okay, now my family is swinging into action, but like, he wants to be the one that everyone is, you know, trying to install into power, but he's not quite
there.
The
second son.
But I'm sure he has a plan for that too.
Yes, we'll see. So we're going to get into this to this moment where Allison and Otto are basically going to send their field agents out on this this mission to retrieve Aegon. No one knows where Aegon is. Aegon is missing. He has gone out somewhere into King's Landing to do some sort of horrible, unspeakable thing, probably. And he needs to be retrieved in order to be installed on the throne. And I think initially I was a little confused about why are Otto and Allison working in this way that is so counter to one another. Where I've landed with it, I really want to know your interpretation, is it feels to me like they both know whoever gets to him first gets to sort of set the tone of this thing. Like if Otto gets Aegon first, he can instruct him on why this has to happen and what has to happen and why that has to happen. Allison gets to do the same thing. And the stakes for Allison are, if I get to Aegon first, then maybe, just maybe, I can convince him to rule kindly rather than cruelly. That seemed to be the stakes to me of like who needs to retrieve Aegon before the other.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. You just have to, this guy, it doesn't want to be in this position. He's a self-involved jerk, you know, and worse. But he is malleable to an extent. I mean, we see that later, you know, kind of in a scary way when he starts to really take in the roar of the crowd. And so I think the thinking is, the best I can do in this moment is get there first and say my piece, and hopefully that just sticks in. And this kid doesn't have like object permanence, you know, or not right. Object permanence, but like he's just so impressionable that like, that will be the kind of presiding ethos that if I can just incept it into him, basically.
Yeah. So Otto's henchmen for the job are going to be the brothers Cargill, Eric and Arik. They now have story involvement, and you're going to have to keep track of an Eric and an Arik. Good luck. I wish you well in the wars to come. As one of them is going to be pretty clearly like, fine with what's going on here. One of them is like, well, I'm a member of the King's Guard, and if Aegon's the king, then that's my job. And the other, and I believe it is Arik, is going to be pretty disgusted with what he has seen of Aegon and what he is seeing happening right now, and is going to be, if not decisively team Rhaenyra, then at the very least, team not Aegon. Team, this is not okay. Mm-hmm. So their storyline is going to be going around King's Landing and the brothers sort of having a little bit of like a philosophical debate about, is this right? Is any of this okay? Meanwhile, Kristen and Aemond are being sent off, that the fate of the Seven Kingdoms depends on them finding Aegon first. And initially, it's just Kristen who is going to be sent off. But Aemond insists that he comes along, that it's not just the brothers Cargill who know where Aegon goes at night. As Aegon's brother, Aemond has a couple of ideas of where to look.
Well, he thinks he does. And I think it's interesting that Aemond is kind of wrong, you know, yeah. Right? I'm remembering that, right? Like he goes to the one brothel and the woman's like, he hasn't been here in ages. Like,
yeah,
he does other things, you know, and then we see, you know, Arik and Arik like at the child fighting pits.
Yeah.
You know, and clearly he's been there because look, there's this blonde headed bastard, I think we're supposed to assume. And they're like, well, one of many.
Yeah, yeah. You know? I think that's the right interpretation, is that there's at least one illegitimate child of Aegon's that is in King's Landing that we have eyes on in this series of scenes.
Yeah.
And I think it's an astute observation that they seem to know what Aegon is up to better than Aegon's own family. And that is probably a pretty important takeaway, right? Of, yeah, like, these people can see a little more clearly what's going on with this kid.
And it's crucial to Aemond in particular, where it's like, what little we've seen of him or know of him so far is like, he's very competent. You know, he's good with the sword. He's strategic. He's whatever. He doesn't really have the social game, but, you know, whatever, that right, matters less. But like, he doesn't actually have all of the pieces in front of him. Like, he's not as aware and up on things as he, at least when it comes to his brother, which is a problem because his brother's about to be king.
Right. So he and Kristen will go to this brothel first. And like you said, this woman is going to say he's not here, hasn't been here in years. His tastes are known to be less discriminating, is what she says of him. And then when she sizes up Aemond, who has not identified himself, she has this line of how you've grown, mm-hmm, which I thought was pretty upsetting. Aemond had come here on his 13th name day, is what he says. I think some pretty unsavory implications with Aemond. And I think that the show has done a decent job, at least for me so far. I don't know about for you, of like rooting Aemond in like this man, like this guy who's going to have one eye on the prize of like, I should be on the throne, or at the very least, we need to be in charge, has really been like molded for this, but there's a lot of trauma underneath his life as well. He's a really interesting character, Aemond Targaryen.
Yeah. I mean, I think this show has done a real, I mean, Game of Thrones Prime did it too, but like, this show is, because it's so steeped in like dynastic, you know, life and struggle, that like, most of these people have had, despite their immense privilege, pretty miserable life. You know, yeah, for one reason or another, or multiple reasons at one. You know, this is a kid who was horribly disfigured in a fight that he kind of started because he was being a jerk. But all these other things have happened to him. He has his brother who's a monster. He has a grandfather who, you know, God knows what. Like, you know, I think Aemond is being sort of pitched not as a villain, but as an anti-hero, let's say.
Yeah.
And yet, yeah, we can still extend some empathy to what was assuredly a rough upbringing.
This whole series of scenes, a lot is kind of like intercutting with each other. A lot of these movements of the episode, of the hunt for Aegon, is happening with all of these with the brothers Cargill, with Aemond and Kristen. But meanwhile, at the Red Keep, Otto is trying to contain this as best as he can as well. He's assembled a bunch of lords and ladies to give them the news about what happened with Viserys and how he had changed his mind. It's not going to be Rhaenyra. It's going to be Aegon. Many of the people in the room bend the knee immediately. One person wants to leave to consult with his family. And Otto says, you're not allowed to leave without declaring your intention. This man says, I'm no oath breaker. I will not bend the knee. One other woman, signs on to that statement. And of course, they are immediately escorted out. With this one last lord who does finally bend the knee, he says, long live the king. He will be apprehended momentarily. He will be caught trying to leave the castle, and he will be hanged for it. So clearly he's just trying to hold out a little bit longer so he can get out in time to spread the word. But I thought that this whole series of sequences around Otto Hightower and the reception of the news of Viserys' death and Aegon's ascension, and like, what do you do in the immediate face of a rising dictatorship, or at least this incredibly naked power grab that's happening right now? I thought that this was fascinating material.
Yeah, I mean, because the situation, not just for the family, but for everyone kind of in their orbit, like, it became so dire so fast. You know, I mean, maybe they should have seen it coming and had a plan, but it also was just like, is the implication that Otto Hightower and his cohort are like having lords and ladies of like old houses murdered, you know, because if that's pretty serious, right?
Yeah. Well, if they're committing to this reality, right? If they are committing to the reality that Viserys's dying wish was that Aegon sits on the Iron Throne and he is the king now, and if you do not bend the knee to the king, then you are an oath breaker. Then they need to commit all the way, I guess, you know, yeah, full measure. Like, they have to treat these people as if they are traitors to the crown. right. and make examples of them. I mean, have to is, you know, a choice of words. But I think from their perspective, it's like, if we're going to go and do this, we have to do this all the way. Right. So yeah, I do think that they're rounding these people up. And I suspect that they are not letting them walk away after they're making these decisions.
Which, of course, creates enemies in their families if the families aren't also killed. And then it creates the kind of bureaucratic headache of having to install someone else to rule that house or whatever. And, you know, so like this is already has really far ranging implications. But Otto seems like, nope, I know what I'm doing. Like, let's keep moving forward.
Yeah. One last bit on this series of scenes is that we are going to see Laris Strong is the one who comes to Otto Hightower and basically talk about how there are spies within your house and I know who to connect you with. And Otto is going to talk to Laris about, you spent a lot of time with my daughter, haven't you? And Laris will say, there's no reason why the hours I've spent with the queen can't benefit you. So here we're seeing with Laris Strong a little bit of playing all the sides that he can, like a little bit of the complexity to his political maneuvering here as he's seeing different possible advantages to being with a couple of different sides of this equation.
Right. And what he's moving into, I think, as we see with this foot scene at some point is later, is that he is kind of tipping the scales where actually Alicent is kind of in. He's in under his control, you right. know, because he's like, he's cozied up to dad. Allison is in a very precarious position and he's the one, Laris, who holds all of the sort of strings and you know, can sway power. And so that's been an interesting dynamic to watch kind of shift over the course of the past, you know, however many episodes.
Yeah. So sticking with Allison, we're going to have a couple of scenes with her. There is the scene where she is with Viserys's body as he is wrapped up and taken away. And then she is going to come to Rhaenys, to the queen who never was, who is still in town. She did not leave alongside the rest of her relatives, apparently. So she has had a front row seat to everything that is happening. She's been locked in her chambers. She's just hearing all the pandemonium outside. And when Alicent comes to her, Rhaenys is no dummy, Richard. She figures out pretty quickly. The king is dead and you're usurping the throne. Right. This scene between these two women, I thought was really, really memorable.
Yeah. And you can see Rhaenys's wheels turning, you know, I mean, the wheels have already been turning, but like here, she's like, okay, now we're fine. Well, I can't believe we're actually here. I kind of thought this maybe was never going to happen. And I got to figure out what I'm doing without my husband. You know, I've got dead children, or at least she thinks two dead children.
Right.
And for all intents and purposes, he is dead. You know, and I think connecting from this scene to the last one is really interesting to think what her thought process is. And like, I don't know that she's necessarily trying to get under Alicent's skin for any reason, but to make a point. You know, I don't know if it's strategic necessarily to say to Alicent, don't you think, didn't you ever think about it yourself? You know, blah, blah, blah. I think she knows that her back is very much up against the wall for now. But still, you know, she's not out of it. She's still on her feet.
Well, I think that she's in a fascinating position where, you know, she has always seen this pretty clearly. You know, she was saying this to the Sea Snake for years and for episodes, certainly, where she says, the closer we get to the center of this thing, the more dangerous it's going to become. You're dragging our family into the eye of the storm. And so she has seen this for many moons now.
And she said it to Rhaenyra when Rhaenyra was a little kid. She said, they would rather put the whole thing to the torch than see you ahead of it. And then at the end of the episode, she has the opportunity to put the royal family to the torch and she doesn't.
Right.
And, so I think she is like, I'm not one of those. I know those guys, they are going to take over, but I'm sort of not opting out. I'm just kind of pivoting a little bit.
Yeah. So I think that she's like, she has this choice in front of her of someone who can see so clearly that she can, you know, she can lean in and not necessarily tip the scales, but she could, I think it would tip the scales to a large degree if she has control over Driftmark and she and the Valyrian fleet are now in the pocket of the Hightowers. That would be huge for the Hightowers, who already possess a bunch of dragons, including Vhagar, and so much else. And clearly, literally, they control King's Landing right now. She could lean in and that would be the safe move. But would it be right? You know, would this be at all even remotely okay? for her to do this, and especially when it's something that she has probably had a lot of time to think about, this inevitability, as we're outlining, that she was talking to Rhaenyra about this, you know, 20 some odd years earlier, almost at this point. So she's in this room effectively going to give her answer of like, thanks, but no thanks. She will give that answer in a much louder way a few scenes from now. But I really appreciated having this scene and having this moment between Alicent and Rhaenyra, or Rhaenys rather, and getting this moment for the two of them to kind of size each other up and see each other for who they really are. Otto is going to meet Missaria, the White Worm. He has been clued into the fact that she might know a thing or two about a thing or two, including the fact that Viserys is dead, which is information that should not have reached her at this point. Otto seems, you know, pretty shook by the fact that she knows this.
Genuinely, yeah. I think it's the first we've really seen him phased in a while, you know?
Yeah.
He's like, wait, what was I? And he immediately is like, give her the money. Give her the money.
Yes.
Like,
give
we need
cash.
To know what's going on. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it's like someone who thinks that they've got like their thumb on the game. Like, this is like if Boston Rob in Redemption Island doesn't know about a thing that's happening, which would be absolutely ridiculous because of all the people on Redemption Island were terrible at Survivor and Boston Rob was the master. Right. And what if all of a sudden Steve Wright was secretly controlling the game? He would be freaked out. And so I think here, yeah. I was like, wait a second, somebody knows more than I do, or somebody knows something that I thought I had on severe lockdown. And he seems really, really shaken by it.
Yeah.
He seems really genuinely, utterly surprised. And I think it does position Missaria as somebody who should not be taken lightly. And yeah. Whether or not Otto walks away from this interaction is like, this is a valuable person to have in my corner, or I have to kill that person fast.
Right.
You know, that's sort of the question that I think we're left with right now.
It's a bit like on Heroes versus Villains when no one knew who Russell Hance was because they hadn't
right,
watched
yes.
his season yet. And
yeah.
then everyone was like, wait a second, this guy keeps doing stuff that I didn't see coming.
Right.
So just a quick thing about how she knew about when she's lighting the candles in the window. Right.
Mm-hmm.
That was the signal. Right. That's how we were supposed to read that.
Right. So I think Talia, who was Alicent's handmaiden, lights the candle. I think that's the signal. Yeah, I think it's
yeah,
like,
okay.
And this is like preparedness, right? This is appropriate levels of preparedness for the espionage network here of like, that man's going to die soon. We should probably have some sort of easy call sign so that we could be ahead of the game once that goes down.
Right.
So yeah, I think that's how I took that as well. So she's going to give the location of Aegon because she knows everything. And she's trading this not just for money, but also she wants Otto's word that basically like child fight club stops, like the treatment of children in Flea Bottom. It's been obscene and horrible and either you're tolerating it or it's gone completely ignored. I want you to address it. That's sort of her terms. Otto promises to look into it.
It's interesting that she has like politics.
Yeah.
You know, I kind of assumed that she was just like doing everything for her own self-interest. But like, no, she like actually has issues that she cares about.
When we saw her back in, I think it was episode 2 on Dragonstone with Daemon, she has, you know, that big speech with him of like, I came to you to be liberated from fear. You know, like I didn't want to be treated the way that I was treated my entire life anymore. I think that she has. That energy has followed her into this position of power that she has found herself in, where I do think authentically, at least I buy, that she wants better for the people of the world. And that if she is in this, you know, position to wield information sharply, those are the angles that she's going for. That's what she wants to cover. That's what she wants to fix. Whether or not, you know, she's aligning herself with the right person, I feel like, especially through this episode, we know enough about Otto Hightower that I don't think that that's really something that he gives any kind of care about.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
But look, on Game of Thrones original, we saw when one woman gains the favor of a bunch of very downtrodden people, like how powerful that can be.
Yes.
In Daenerys, obviously, with Misa. So I don't know. I think we should definitely keep our eyes on her in a way that I didn't think we needed to before, like,
yeah,
because we spent so much time with the townsfolk in this episode, and here we have someone who is advocating for the most downtrodden of those people, as a huge power shift happens. Like, that's a really interesting dynamic to have now introduced into the show.
She's kind of, for the show at this moment in time, the voice of the people, right? Like, I think that she's sort of representing that contingent that has gone unrepresented on the show in many regards. So absolutely somebody to keep on our radar for sure. We get to this final clash of swords over who gets to Aegon. Eric and Arik find him first, but Kristen and Aemon have been following them. And so it's, you know, a little bit of like, okay, we need to, it's been a while since we've had some sword play on the show. So we just have to have a little bit of a quick skirmish here to wrap this story up.
Yeah, I was glad that the quick skirmish didn't end in blood, you know, bloodshed. That was a relief. Yeah.
Although, like, if you could have just get rid of one of Eric and Arik, it would be a little easier to follow, maybe.
Well, sure. But yeah. I don't know. I really liked them in this episode. They had a nice energy to them. You know, they seemed
okay,
decent.
I was curious because I think, like, they kind of come out of nowhere. And they do have a really important role to play in this episode of not just, like, trying to find Aegon, but having, you know, sort of representing, like, the Thanksgiving dinner table of like you and your uncle who wildly disagree about the state of the world and what should be done about it and how you don't want to have that conversation. But when you do have that conversation, it's going to be hard for it to not be kind of explosive. It feels like Arik and Arik sort of represent that energy in their conflicting opinions about Aegon. And I really liked seeing that because I like the story of these characters, I think is an interesting one. But I was curious to know how it would read for, like, this is sort of them coming into the story at this really important moment, almost completely out of nowhere.
Maybe they could have been introduced a little bit more, you know, in past episodes, just so we could really be able to follow this most, you know, most clearly. But they're an interesting energy. I think that part of it, and why I keep going back to like this King's Landing citizens too, is that so much of this season has been so cloistered in just this small group of people. That it's nice in this episode that we zoom out a little bit to see the Cargills and then a lot to see the people of King's Landing to be like, right, there are a lot of other people in this and affected by it and who aren't just totally cowering in fear the whole time. Like they actually act, they make choices, they defend themselves, etc.
Yeah. So Kristen and Aemon are going to win out over Arik and Arik, and We see them grab Aegon. They bring Aegon back home, and Otto and Alicent are going to do the post-mortem on all of this. They're going to recap the day. Otto says, wow, well done. A charming contest. And I feel like this is a real gloves-off scene between father and daughter at this moment in time, where Otto's saying, listen, we've depended on each other, and now like everything is for the good of the family. I don't know why our differences should divide us so clearly. Alicent, in this moment, I think feels emboldened to be like, I've never been really your daughter. I've just been a pawn on the board for you to move around. And Otto doesn't say no to that. Otto's like, well, if that's true, then I made you queen of the Seven Kingdoms. Isn't that a pretty good deal?
Right. Yeah. And, you know, I think he's a little bit like proud of her by the end of the scene, but also like, not threatened by her. You know, what does he say at the very end? Like, as you wish.
Yeah.
And it's a little sarcastic and it's a little
you look so much like your mother in certain lights, is what he'll say to her, which feels very patronizing, if not a little darker than patronizing.
Yeah, I think he's just like, I think he'll work to make sure she doesn't get killed, but I think he's also not that, like, she has fulfilled her purpose, you know, now we're on to the next, now we're on to the boy. And I think that, like, a lot of this episode is, and why there was that crucial scene between Alicent and Rhaenys, is Alicent really finally realizing, like, I didn't matter to them except as, you know, this vessel to birth children and to marry this guy. That was it.
Right. Whatever power she has is about to become irrelevant. And I think for Alicent, getting to Aegon first for her was critical if she's to maintain any semblance of control in this situation. And I think for Otto, it would have been preferable to get to Aegon. But I think he's like, that's not the end of the game for me that you got him first. Like the stakes of that situation were very different for Alicent and Otto. And I think that you get that from Otto's energy in this room versus Alicent's. I think Alicent leaves this room having had a very exhausting conversation, a confrontational conversation with her father, you know, the kind of thing where your blood is going to boil as you are facing down this person who literally gave you life and giving them the business, only for that person to kind of be like, yeah, okay, you know, yeah, cute.
Yeah,
it's horrible. You know,
yeah, it is. Yeah, it's so diminishing. Yeah,
yeah. So she walks away with that, and then we get to Alicent and Lord Larys, and we get into Quentin Tarantino's favorite scene of the night, as Alicent is going to, she's going to like put her feet on the table, and at first it kind of felt like a power move to me, of like, Larys, yeah, you can't quite do this.
I read it that way, but I also thought for a sec, well, because I started the scene being nervous when she poured herself a drink. I was like, oh no, she's going to get poisoned, because like I'm in paranoia mode for her.
Right, of course.
But then she takes her feet and then she put shoes off and puts her feet up. And I was like, oh, this is kind of sweet. Like she kind of feels comfortable, you know, like, oh, that's nice. And then you very quickly are like, oh no, that's not what this is about.
No. I do not recall any such material in Fire and Blood. I think that the historians did not chronicle Larys Strong, a.k.a. Larys Clubfoot's foot fetish. But apparently he has one, because he's masturbating to the sight of Alicent's feet on the table.
And this is not the first time this has happened, clearly.
Game of Thrones is Game of Thrones-ing very hard in this moment, and I don't know. I don't know that I needed this. I don't know what it's adding thematically, honestly. I think like it's pretty reductive, of like, here's like the gross schemer. And also like the fact that there's like the foot fixation feels, I don't know, kind of wildly insensitive to people with his condition.
Yeah.
I don't know. I didn't love it. I think this is pretty easily my least favorite part of the episode. And it's not because I'm like squeamish and prude. You can throw a lot of really weird, wacky material my way, and I'll enjoy it if it's thematic and if it serves a purpose. This kind of, for me, felt like, well, we need to have like one really gross thing in the episode, and so let's give it here. And I think it's pretty diminishing of Larys as a character, and not so great for the way that Alicent is being handled as a character either. I just didn't love it.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think you already have the slight, you know, difficulty of having a character with a disability also being the sneaky villain, which is not saying that can't happen,
right?
But you have to treat that, you know, with texture, you know, and interestingly and thoughtfully. I think they mostly done that, but then this scene, it's like, yeah, making the one-to-one comparison between his disability and his sexual interest, like, that's not great. But also, I think that we've just gotten a couple of scenes where Alicent has realized she doesn't have power. Why do we need this extra kind of debasement? You know, it's like she has to do this thing so this guy can sit there to what, keep him in her favor, like, you know, it just felt a little gratuitous, not for the sexual aspect, but for the like kind of further pushing Alicent down. Like, we get it, we just had the scene that defined that, you know.
Yeah, I totally agree, and I think like that seems to be how I read the scene, as far as like, what's the purpose of it? It feels like Alicent's like, this is my way of keeping Larys close to me, and like, is there not just like better way of finding Larys's kryptonite, you know? Like, this is his kryptonite. It's just a strange choice for me, and I think a bad choice ultimately. I don't know how this turns into something interesting. I think it just is, you know, kind of in the pantheon of like gratuitous Game of Thronesness. And I didn't need it. I thought we were in like very cerebral, interesting, philosophical territory. And then Larys does the business to the feet. And
if they wanted to twist it some and have it be that Alicent likes this, and because we don't really know much about Alicent's like sexual life, that would be interesting. But the fact that she turns away and it's sort of this gross thing she has to endure, this Louis C.K. kind of thing, I don't know. I just feel like this show has been better than original Game of Thrones with giving women agency while also still being like, women are in a very precarious position in this world, which as they are in our world, we didn't need this extra added sort of thing unless they were going to do something more interesting with it, which they so far have not.
So we are going to go from that to, you know, a bit of a montage of everybody sort of waiting for the next day. Aegon has been secured. Unhappily, he does not like that he has been secured. He does not like that this is the position he is being thrust in. Aemon also does not like this. There was a scene earlier that we kind of yada yada through, but talked about lightly, where Aemon is going to have this moment with Kristen, where he's like, if I was on the throne, this wouldn't be a problem. And maybe we want to find Aegon in a bad situation so that we can just yada yada our way through Aegon as well. And it seems like Kristen is like quasi interested in that, but also is still clinging to whatever like illusion of loyalty he has and honor that he has. But that conversation existing, that Aemon thinks that he's the one of the two of his brothers that is best suited to sit on the Iron Throne. So on the eve of Aegon's ascension, I think that Aemon is still having daydreams of who should really be the ruler of this realm.
Yeah, and probably thinking through some different pathways to that. You know, like, obviously the best one is wait it out with King Aegon and maybe strike against him subtly, or hope that he, I don't know, gets syphilis and dies or something.
Right.
You know, and then you ascend. Or dangling on the other side in the distance is like, maybe I switch alliances somehow and somehow maneuver that, which, you know, I'm sure that this character, as much as we understand this character, has not entirely ruled out.
No. So that's what's going on in the night before. And then really interestingly, on the eve of Aegon's ascension, is Eric Cargill being like, enough. No, this is not going to stand, and I'm going to do something about it. And he is going to break Rhaenys free from her prison, and say, I'm not going to let this treachery stand. Let's get out of here. And so they're going to wind and weave their way out of the city and into the next day. This is where we get this this really fascinating series of scenes where the bells are ringing out, signaling the death of Viserys, signaling this change in leadership here in King's Landing. And now we're kind of rooted in Rhaenys's perspective of the people of the streets kind of in a panic. She gets separated from Eric. And she is going to wind and weave her way towards the dragon pit. In considering this on the other side of seeing where all of this goes, Richard, I do think it's really interesting that she starts off kind of as like a point of view of the people in the streets, considering like she will not consider them at all when she just bursts free on Dragonback.
I think the most interesting part of this whole episode, and I'm really curious to hear what you think it was, what is that smile that she... But is it when she realizes, oh, we're being herded toward where they keep the dragons? You know, because she looks up kind of through the crowd and sees the sky in a building. Is that what that smile is about, where she's like, ah, I'm being led toward sort of my way out?
Yeah, I mean, I think a ship out of King's Landing would have been nice if that was the only option available to her. But if she is being literally corralled to the place where she knows that her dragon is parked, that she's got the keys to that specific ride, that she is going to be able to make quite an entrance during the coronation and certainly quite the exit. So I think that there is a piece of that, but I think that there's also probably some degree to which, you know, she's kind of like an anti-Arya in this moment, I think, or at least like a really interesting comparison to Arya when you think about this episode in relation to Baelor of Game of Thrones season one. Where Arya is sort of our eyes from the perspective of the audience to the execution of her father, of Ned Stark, and she doesn't know what's going on, even if we kind of begin to process what is going on. And in this case, I think Rhaenys, like, she knows what's going on. She is being, like, shepherded into the audience for this coronation, and unlike Arya, she can see every last bit of it for what it is. And unlike Arya, who would have loved nothing more than to be able to cross out some names on her list immediately in that moment, Rhaenys has the opportunity to do exactly that. And she can make the choice as to whether or not she's going to cross any names out.
Yes, totally. I think I'm also choosing to read the smile a little bit as an indication of something we've kind of, you know, intangibly talked about, is like that way out. These people stuck in this stressful, paranoid, cloistered life. Here's Rhaenys just in a crowd, looking at the sky, looking at the city. And for a second, she's kind of free. You know, she's so anonymous. Like she's able to slip away later in the crowd and go get on the dragon and then join, you know, gets right back into the thick of things. But like for a second there, it's like the end of Castaway where she could go any which way. And I think, I don't know, I think the smile is mostly because she realizes, ah, I figured it out. But also she's kind of enjoying herself.
Yeah, a little bit. I think also, like, I can't believe this. Like, I think it's a little bit of like a almost like an exasperated smile. Like, they're really doing it.
You're kidding me. This
you
is
know, happening. Exactly. And you're doing it in the dragon pit, you idiots. Like, I think is definitely another piece of it. Aegon and Allison are on their way towards the coronation. She's going to tell them, have the decency at least to look grateful. In an hour, you're going to be the king. And Aegon is going to be talking about how my father never wanted this for me. He could have changed his mind at any point. He never did. He didn't like me. And Allison is going to continue to repeat this line that she does seem to believe of he wanted you to take the throne with his final breath. That's what he wanted. And she even presents him with the Valyrian dagger. And he says, do not toy with me, mother. And I think to me, I would expect that Aegon understands that this dagger was very important to his father, was greatly associated with Viserys and the Targaryen dynasty. But I think it is interesting to me, Richard, that no one really is around to explain to him what it actually means. None of that history, none of the culture around it exists on this side of the Targaryen family tree.
Right. And so when will he be clued into that? Because no one in his inner circle or the people who were kind of pulling his strings, they're not privy to that. You know, that's on the other side. And, you know, obviously we know it's going to come to bear much, much later for this world. But for now, yeah, it's funny to see this hugely important, like, talisman reduced to just like, no, it's your dad's nice thing that he had. Now it's yours, you know?
Yeah, yeah. This seems to be the thing that that revs him up, that kind of sobers him up and gets him ready for the moment. Where we're kind of in his perspective as the coronation is occurring. There's the big announcement of Viserys the Peaceful is dead. By the way, like we're honoring like the death of the peaceful king. Like we're already honoring him that way and like titling him as such. Feels like Otto being like, yeah, and the next king is going to be like the Warful.
Right. And it's
we know where this is going.
It's like, you know, we won't speak ill of the dead. Like, he was kind of ineffectual this, but like now we get to reframe that in death as peaceful,
right?
You know, yeah. Like now
Viserys the nothing burger doesn't quite have the same
right.
ring. To
exactly.
It.
Yeah. Viserys the cucked or whatever.
Yes.
I don't know.
Right.
But yeah. I did just going really quickly back to the carriage scene. I did like the way it ended where he's like, do you love me? And she calls him an imbecile.
Right.
And she doesn't answer the question. And so you go into this next scene being like, all right, how does Allison feel about this kid? Obviously, she knows he does terrible things, whatever, but she's still his mom. And I think you see an interesting shift as this process goes on. And as the crowd is kind of trying to figure out how to react to it, where like Allison does, I think, by the end, get towards something like pride.
Yeah. And I think that Aegon receives that as such. You know, all of the people on stage bow their heads to him, and all of the people who are people that he either looked up to or feared or like had to respect but secretly loathed, all of them are bowing their heads to him. And I think that he's, you know, I don't know if he's taking this as like, I'm king shit now, and like this is me and I earned this, or if it's I have the crown and they have to do this and that's a tool that I can use. But either way, I think sort of in the same vein as when Aemon was so exhilarated on the other side of claiming Vhagar, that energy is here with Aegon. I think that he is finally swept up in it. He has Aegon the Conqueror's crown. He has Aegon the Conqueror's sword, Blackfyre. He, you know, feels very much a Targaryen king in this moment. And I think it's so interesting to me to see that transformation of this kid who, much like Jon Snow, I don't want it, suddenly has it, now maybe wants it, and immediately in that moment is confronted with potential imminent Dragonfire doom as Rhaenys, who has escaped in the crowd, has gone into the depths of the dragon pit, has her dragon, Maelys, I believe is the name of her dragon, Maelys maybe. She bursts forward with it and has the opportunity to just incinerate these fools.
Yeah. And Allison closes her eyes and she's like, well, this is it. And there's a tiny part of you that's like, is she like finally, you know, like
totally.
Let's just totally. Avoid all this and just come
it's
on.
It's kind of like, this is a mercy. Make it quick.
You know, yeah. Like Lena did it. Like, you know, okay, let's go for it. But you know, I think it's also funny with the Aegon of it all. Like, I was thinking about. Sometimes I do like on stage Q&As for like post screenings or yeah. Anytime I have to do a public speaking thing, I get really nervous and I'd like
sure.
The hours before I'm like, why did I agree to do this? It's so stupid.
Yeah. Relatable.
And then the minute that mic turns on and the lights are on, the theater kid in me from high school and college just comes roaring out and I'm mm-hmm. just like, I never want to leave the stage. And you kind of see that with Aegon where it's like, wait a second, this feels amazing.
Yes. You know,
all of this attention. And I think that's a really interesting and very credible character lead, you know, evolution that happens in a second that then is, of course, yes, like immediately challenged by this thing where, you know, it's almost all over. And then Rhaenys makes a really interesting decision that, I mean, we've kind of already talked about, but like that is something that I kind of thought, okay, we're at the penultimate episodes of these shows tend to be the big violent ones where something major happens, not always, but a lot of the time. And this show pulled its punch, which I thought was actually more interesting because I was expecting a bloodbath and or a fire bath or whatever. And that's not what happened.
Yeah, I really, you know, I thought about this a lot with how the show handles Viserys's exit from the stage versus Ned Stark's exit from the stage in Game of Thrones as being sort of like a very different path towards the same inevitable outcome of your number one on the call sheet leaving prematurely, you know, coming into House of the Dragon. We've seen so much Game of Thrones that it's really expected that Patty Considine is not going to be on the show forever. And in fact, this show can't really become what it's supposed to become, this war of succession, if he's still around. So, you know, he's going to live or, you know, he's going to die eventually, but you have no real sense that like, he's going to live as long as he did. You know, he lived a lot longer than I think a lot of the non-book reading prognosticators would have guessed. And his death ends up being, you know, this inevitability, but extended. And I think in this moment, the Game of Thrones trope has you ready to believe, okay, maybe Rhaenys is going to incinerate all of the Hightowers. We've been invested in the Hightowers, like getting themselves into the position of power to claim the throne once Viserys is gone. But what happens if Rhaenys just torches them all, then walks on stage, picks up the crown, and this is Rhaenyra's new opponent? You know, I think that there's a lot of like the galaxy-brained Game of Thrones thinking that's going on in that moment of watching this go down. And instead, it's this other choice of, no, we will resist the Game of Thrones trope of wiping out a family in a penultimate episode. And that will be interesting because this moment for this family, where they very easily could have just been in one fell swoop completely wiped from the table, you got to imagine they're not going to forget what this feels like. And you have to imagine that this really is going to crystallize for them what they are actually up against potentially,
yeah,
and what they're going to need to do in response to somebody who had so much power over us in this particular moment.
And yet now we almost owe something to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that it's a shrewd thing on Rhaenys's part because she has not technically declared a side. I mean, she's declared that she's against the common folk who were yes. in that building. But R. in R. terms P. of the people who matter, she's like, right. I didn't kill you. I was just leaving. You guys weren't letting me leave. I am an autonomous person. I decided to go when I wanted to go. You yeah. decided to have it in the parking garage. So I got my my whip and I left. Mm-hmm. So she hasn't said, she didn't fly away yelling, I'm Team Rhaenyra. She didn't do that. So right. I think it's an interesting, I mean, obviously she has more to align with Rhaenyra about because of, you know, blood and relatives and all that. But you know, the grandkids and whatnot. But, you know, like she hasn't declared a side yet, which I think was ultimately her strategy. And I think probably a good one.
So that's where we leave it with this big sort of explosive moment that kills a bunch of NPCs, but none of the playable characters. So Rhaenys is on Dragonback, flying off to who knows where, and it leaves us on the doorstep of the season one finale. We did not see Rhaenyra Targaryen or her side of the family in this entire episode, completely withheld from us throughout the Green Council. next week's episode entitled The Black Queen. I think fair to say that we are going to get the answer to how Rhaenyra is going to feel about all of this.
Is it better to be part of a Green Council or be the Black Queen? You know,
I think, I was going to say I'd rather just be one of the common folk, but
I want to be hopefully she's, you know, everyone's unionized, but the brothel owners seem to be kind of, you know, she's like, I have a thriving business and I can kind of talk sassy to royalty because, like, whatever, you know, she seemed to be doing okay as long as she's treating her employees well.
Sometimes I really understand why the sea snake just keeps going back to the Stepstones. It's like, get me out of this.
Oh, fully. I want to be like in a library in Old Town. That's, far away from all this.
I think that that's fair. I think that's fair. We've got some feedback from the still watching faithful here, Richard, to bring into the conversation. This came our way from Tim K, who had written in. And said, much was made of the value of Vhagar to the Greens, but in a post-show featurette, it was frequently mentioned how as dragons age, they eventually get to a point where they are essentially too big to support their own bodies. So I wonder how much longer Vhagar will be in fighting shape and how much value she is to Aemond, as he is still pretty young. I think Tim is sort of sizing up the battlefield here as the lines have clearly been drawn. I do think maybe that speaks to why, like, Aemon's first move after Rhaenys leaves isn't to just go downstairs and rev up, like, the monster truck that is Vhagar. Like, she's in a Corvette and she's, you know, speeding off. I don't think he's going to really, even on the biggest dragon in the land, going to be able to catch up to her so quick.
Right. It's the Mario Kart thing of, I always choose small and fast cars, but other people like the bigger, slower ones, you know? So,
yeah. I'm inclined to play as Wario whenever given the option.
See, okay, so my boyfriend is the same way, where I'm like, give me Peach, give me Yoshi. Mm-hmm. I want the agility.
Yeah. I just like to go, wow, you know, as much as I can as I'm playing Mario Kart. This came from Kristen, who, no surprise, had a lot to say about Kristen on the show. And Kristen wondered, had some questions about the switch of sworn protector Sir Criston Cole from Rhaenyra to the Queen, just because he's all hurt because the princess doesn't want to run off with him and he ultimately was going to take his own life, only to have the Queen find him and stop him. How does his job just change from the princess to the queen, and how come no one said anything to explain it? Well, all of this is, you know, sort of just like hand waved away in that time jump, Richard. But did this episode give you any clarity as far as Criston Cole's like real authentic feelings about his place in this society, his place in this particular situation? Is this just a revenge kick against Rhaenyra for him? Or did you catch anything in terms of how he's feeling about Alicent after all of this? You have to imagine she played a humongous role in him not only getting to keep his job, but, you know, potentially getting to keep his life after what happened at the wedding.
Well, I think there's some instructive stuff in this episode where he says to Aemond when they're at the brothel door, where he's like, don't talk about women like that, you know, kind of thing.
Right.
I think Criston is in his mind trying to restore the honor that he besmirched by sleeping with Rhaenyra that one time. And so I think that's part of it. But I think really Criston is emerging, or has emerged, as just a bad guy who, like, you know, kind of punishes women for what he thinks, or sort of puts women at a sort of remove because of his sort of internal conflicts about women. And like, I think that, like, he probably now thinks that he's in love with Alicent to some degree, because that's how his kind of mind thinks. He can't really see women as peers. They're sort of objects of either protection or lust or both or whatever. And so, yeah, I think he's just like a toxic man. That's what I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Kristen wasn't a huge fan. Kristen, the feedbacker, wasn't a huge fan of the actor change for Rhaenyra and Alicent. We got feedback that was similar from Maya as well, but this is from a few weeks back. I would be curious to know if Kristen and Maya and anyone else who hasn't been feeling the actor change for Rhaenyra and for Alicent, the Emma Darcy and Olivia Cooke era, if they're feeling differently now. Obviously, nothing new from Emma Darcy in this episode, other than their strong advocation offline for Negronis. But a really strong episode from Olivia Cooke once again, I thought.
Oh, incredible. Yeah, she's really great.
I think this version of Alicent, there's just a lot of layers here, a lot of layers. Christina had written in and said, between Ned Stark, Oberyn Martell, and now Harwin Strong, does anyone notice how good dads don't live long in Westeros? Notably absent from that list, Richard, would be King Viserys. I think this feedback sent in shortly before his death, or at least before HBO confirmed it with their trailer. Yeah, I don't know what this is. Do the bad dads tend to live relatively long lives?
I think dads in general are in trouble.
But, people in general are real danger in this world.
But yeah, I mean, I think one of the sort of occasionally oppressive things about watching these two shows is that, like, you're just starved for any glimmer of, like, decency or warmth or, you know, kindness or whatever. You get it in little fits and starts, but then it's usually ruined, like, a scene later. You know, I'm thinking about young Laenor and young Rhaenyra on the beach, and they're like, oh, that's nice. And then you're like, but that's not going to last, you know? And I think that, any kind of, like, kind parenting that is reciprocated, like, that's not going to be short-lived just because that's not the world of the story.
A couple more. This was from Bridget, who said, I know it's not part of the Game of Thrones universe playbook, though I heard that it was a Benioff and Dan Weiss thing, but I think that flashbacks would have worked fine if we needed to cover several decades quickly in this first season. So I think Bridget out here advocating for flashbacks, which I think is interesting right now in, like, the week following Paddy Considine's official exit from the series. He's done a few interviews, Richard, where he's made it clear that even though he loved this role, it's his favorite role he's gotten to play, he wouldn't be particularly interested in a reprise of any kind. And I know that there's a lot of people, including myself, who would really love to see Emily Carey and Millie Alcock back on the show at some point in time. Sounds like Paddy Considine wouldn't want to join them in any kind of future flashback scene. I would be here for it, but I am also here for him living his best life. And if this is his best life, then stay away from the dragons.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, I think that flashbacks, I think that they ultimately made the right choice by presenting it to us linearly. You know, I do actually, in hindsight, like that. I think flashbacks could get a bit gimmicky or distracting if they were, because they would have to be used a lot, you know?
Yeah.
But going forward, if we did want to see those younger actors again, who were really great, I think there would be a moment, perhaps next season or something, of real poignancy where you start the episode or whatever, you end the episode or maybe bookend the episode with a memory of a sweeter, nicer time between these two women, you know?
Yeah.
So I think you could do that for an emotional button, but I think in terms of trying to get us to know these characters as we have over the course of this season, I think they ultimately did choose the right approach, even though the time jumps have been at times a little, you know, jarring.
Yeah. This from Amanda, also Angelica, a few people who had written in just to clear the record on why the Valyrians are able to ride dragons. It would be due to Rhaenys' Targaryen blood flowing through their veins. I thought this was relevant to bring up now as we are really, and I was really excited for the moment that we would see Rhaenys on Dragonback at some point in time. I think if anyone was really looking forward to that, this episode very much delivered on what that might look like.
Yes.
Yeah. And then finally, Michelle gave a lot of love for the podcast, big fan of the podcast, and she made a direct plea, Richard, to get you on a Brant Steele podcast over on RHAP or Post Show Recaps. And I cannot imagine you know what a Brant Steele is, Richard, but it is, as you are revealing your Survivor fandom to me, becoming a personal mission of mine to make Michelle's dreams come true. So we'll talk offline.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, to me, to be perfectly honest, Brant Steele sounds like a particular kind of adult performer, but
you know, but there's a way of looking at it where that might actually not be terribly far off. I've appreciated the Still Watching podcast kind of becoming my night's watch of Survivor podcasting. Took the black, and here I am talking about Survivor still. So I think that's going to do it. Unless you've got anything else on House of the Dragon this week, Richard, only one episode left is kind of wild to me.
Yeah. I mean, I know we've gone long, but that's because we, you know, I'm glad we got to those emails.
Big episode.
And please do still keep emailing us, everyone. I was saying to a friend the other day who said it in kind, he said it in kind of a semi, like, you know, mock, like, ashamed way. He was like, I kind of love the show. And I agreed with him. I was a little bit skeptical at the beginning, but I'm really invested now. And I think that's not just because we've committed all this time to it, but also just because I think they've done really good things. The performances have been great. The writing has been shrewd. And, like, you know, we said about this episode, I'm genuinely surprised by it more and more.
Yeah, I think that we, you know, a lot of the work to get us to the place that we are at heading into episode 9 and now certainly heading out of it. I think that, you know, the time jumpiness and sort of these sort of contrary arguments across the discourse of the season thus far of it's moving too fast and yet it's moving too slow. I think I'm in this place of I think they Goldilocks did. I think it was just right. And I do think that I am feeling pretty ready for what's coming next. But I feel especially prepared for it because of all of the time that we've gotten to spend with Alicent, with Rhaenyra, with the people around them. And I am in hindsight, really grateful for that family dinner they had 1 week earlier. Yeah. Seems like it's going to be a minute before we get another family dinner for the full assembled Targaryen family unit. But we'll find out. We'll see what it looks like for Rhaenyra and her family next week in the season finale of House of the Dragon, The Black Queen, coming 1 week from now. If you want to get your feedback in for that episode, we would love to hear it. StillWatchingPod@gmail.com. That's StillWatchingPod@gmail.com. Richard, where can folks find you? Anything you want to plug going on here on Vanity Fair?
As ever, Twitter at Rylaws on VF.com. Also, we should mention a programming note. We do not have a screener for the last episode. So this Still Watching episode will be airing, sometime midday Monday, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. So we will be a little later on the podcast than normal. We appreciate your patience as we watch this episode, just like the rest of you. We are now in the common folk with the common folk of the Dragon Pit, Richard, just waiting for a dragon to explode upon yeah. us. So, gosh, that was phrased horribly. You can find me on Twitter at Round Howard. You can find me at Round Howard wherever you can find me on the internet. Including right here, VF.com, where I am recapping House of the Dragon, also writing some breakouts, including some Easter eggs from this episode. I have an article up on VF.com right now that's delineating some of the ways that this episode was really different from how all of this went down in the book. I thought it was pretty fascinating, some of the choices that they chose to make. So if that's interesting to you, check it out, VF.com. Of course, huge thanks to the dragon that breaks through the Dragon Pit every week and makes this podcast possible, the great Dave Gonzalez. We appreciate you for everything that is being done to make Still Watching happening. And Still Watching will continue to happen next week when we return for the season finale of House of the Dragon. Until then, everybody, take care. Bye-bye.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Oh. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.